K-Mud Podcast presents.
Wow. Good morning, and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I'll be with you until 10 a.m. And I opened with Robbie Robinson from the Mohawk Nation giving us Making a Noise from his great CD, Contact from the Underworld of Red Boy. Well, I was, been really concerned about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge because, Trump had opened it up for leases, and I kept waiting to hear news because this issue is kind of really close to my heart. I was really got involved in the 1980s, and I met Sarah James, a Gitchewan indigenous woman who was fighting to save that area. I met her through International Indian Treaty Council and the American Indian Movement, and she would come down from Alaska, and she made it to San Francisco. She always made sure she had someone drive her up to Humboldt County to visit me. So we spent a lot of time together, and we had one memorial occasion in Ecuador. We were there for the preparations for the 500 years of resistance, and we, all of us, had gone up to Otavalo, which is north of Quito. And coming back, we had missed all the bus, but it was her and me and another Native woman and a couple of people. We got the bus to come back to Quito. Some people spent the night in Otavalo. We decided to come back to Quito. Well, we got back around 6 in the morning, and the other indigenous woman, I can't remember her name, but she, opened up her suitcase and she goes, "Look, I got this 2-pound box of See's candy, and I was going to give it away." And we all started laughing, and me and Sarah and this woman sat for the next 3 or 4 hours eating chocolates and telling stories. And Sarah told me some beautiful stories about what it's like to live near the Arctic wildlife refuge. And so I've been following this. And recently, Kawana Rose, really, having grown up there, even though she's Lakota and Inuit, she is an incredible outspoken person. So, this week I've been waiting and waiting, and there was nothing in the news, and I wouldn't have known what happened if it wasn't for Kawana posting on Instagram, who I follow. But then, and so I got my whole show together, but this morning, in my inbox, yes, there was information, because I was just going to just give a little blip about it. And of course, this comes from, Brandy Morin, and she's the award-winning Cree Iroquois French journalist from Treaty 6 territory in Alberta, Canada. Her work has appeared in National Geographic, Al Jazeera English, The Guardian, The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and the BBC. She's also the author of the national best-selling memoir, Our Voice of Fire, and she's a founder of the Indigenous Insider on Substack. And thank you, Brandy, for sharing this story, because I like good stories. The drills aren't coming. Well, not today. Another oil and gas auction putting up the Arctic refuge for the taking has flopped, and the land known to the Gitchewan, which translates to the sacred place where life begins, is breathing again, for now. This isn't the first time big oil has taken a pass. In January of 2025, the Biden administration offered 400,000 acres of the refuge coastal plain and received zero bids. The 2021 sale under the first Trump term drew just a handful of takers, mostly a state-sponsored Alaska corporation, and all those leases were eventually forfeited. And when Trump's administration held the most recent sale this June, pumping up nearly 700,000 acres of the coastal plain, one of the last truly intact ecosystems on the planet, big oil largely stayed away again. The sale scrapped together just $3.7 million, less than the price of a Manhattan penthouse. That's what they tried to sell the porcupine caribou herds calving grounds for. There's something the market seemed to understand, even when the administration won't admit it. Some places are too costly to touch, not just financially, though the legal battles, the remote terrain, the reputational risk have all driven away every major oil company. Every major bank in the United States and Canada has adopted policies refusing to finance the Arctic refuge drilling. Global insurers have followed. Chevron and BP walked away from their Arctic leases, some paying millions of dollars to do so. You see, even these industry giants get the point. We cannot ravage everything. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge spans 19.6 million acres across northeastern Alaska, America's largest wildlife refuge, and one of the few places on Earth still entirely free from industrial development. It was first set aside by President Dwight Eisenhower in 1960 to preserve its, quote, unique wildlife, wilderness, and recreational values. It is the summer breeding grounds for millions of migratory birds that travel from all 50 U.S. states and six continents. It is a home to nearly 200,000-strong porcupine caribou herd, to polar bears, wolves, musk oxen, ringed seals, and hundreds of other species. It is not a resource. It is a world. And it's home, the traditional territory of both the Inupit and the Quechuan peoples, who have lived in deep relationship with this land since time immemorial. For the Quechuan, 15 small villages across northeastern Alaska and northwestern Canada, the coastal plain, the 1.5 million acre heart of the refuge where the caribou come to give birth, is not a potential revenue source. It is sacred ground. She says, I met Kawana Chasing Horse at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in New York City in 2025. She traveled there with the Quechuan Steering Committee to fight for her home. The Han Quechuan model and actress from Eagle Village, Alaska, did not mince words when I asked her about Trump's aggressive drill, baby, drill agenda. Quote, I just want to say beep that, she said. Sorry, not sorry. I know a lot of our people in our communities, a lot of our elders are saying they have to kill me before they get to the Arctic. They have to get through me before they get through the Arctic. So I know that people are willing to put their lives on the line to protect what is left and what is sacred. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to be pushing back and fighting this, and we're not going to quit and we're not going to stop. It's not just our food security and the sacredness of our lands, but it is the safety of our people and our women. Crystal Frank Welker, Quechuan from Arctic Village, Alaska, was there the same week, and her words cut just as deep. Quote, it would take away the one thing that we always depended on. It is a part of who we are as a people, our spirituality, our connection, and our way of life. And all of those things that make up who we are will be just another story in history again of things taken away from the indigenous people. And it breaks my heart that could potentially happen. We speak up as women because of our children, for the kids in the community. We want them to have the same experiences as we had growing up harvesting caribou. She also spoke of a moment out on the land, and the image of it hasn't let go. Quote, last fall, I was up on the mountain and I saw the caribou come across the ridge, and it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. A cow came up with a baby, and the baby looked over at me, and I looked at the baby caribou. There's always been this thousand-year connection of them knowing us and us knowing them. We've always been a part of their migration, and even they know who we are. Oil development in the Arctic refuge would be incredibly detrimental to our people. It's one of the places that hasn't been touched, and we'd like it to remain that way for many generations to come. 1,000 years, a baby caribou, an eye meeting another eye across the ridge of a mountain that has never known the sound of a drill. Tell me that isn't sacred. The auction didn't flop in a vacuum. Indigenous communities and environmental groups have been fighting this with everything they have. On April 28th of 2026, Kristen Moreland, executive director of the Getchewan Steering Committee, sent letters directly to executives at eight major oil and gas companies, formally requesting meetings and formally making clear that the Getchewan Nation's opposition is not symbolic. It is absolute. Her words, after the most recent lease sale, landed without softness. Quote, yet again, no major oil and gas companies showed up to bid because they know that drilling in the Arctic Refuge is a losing proposition. Earlier, when the Trump administration first announced its plans to auction off the coastal plain, she said, quote, we have been raising our voices and fighting for the protection of this sacred land and our way of life for decades, and we are not backing down now. She went further, speaking to a responsibility that belongs to everyone. Quote, this is also the larger responsibility we all share to address climate change and to protect one of the last truly intact ecosystems in the world. The Getchewan Steering Committee, alongside the Alaska Wilderness League, the Sierra Club, and the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, Yukon, filed lawsuits against the Interior Department, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, alleging violations of the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Wilderness Act, and more. Conservation leaders also sent their own letters urging oil giants to stay out. The Wilderness Society, Earth Justice, the Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of the Earth, a coalition of groups that knows this is not a battle that ends. Because it hasn't ended. The Trump administration has mandated four lease sales over 10 years as part of a 2017 Congressional Budget Reconciliation Bill. The auctions may keep flopping, the legal challenges continue, and somewhere in a boardroom, someone may still be doing the math on what it would take. The wildlife, the waterways, the pristine, the holy, and they are holy, are worth protecting. They're worth keeping intact. Maybe the oil companies have more soul than the administration pushing them towards these lands. Or maybe it's just math. Either way, for now, the porcupine caribou herd is calving in peace. The polar bears are denning undisturbed. The millions of migratory birds are nesting in a tundra that has not yet been torn apart. A baby caribou is standing on a ridge somewhere, meeting the eyes of a Getchewan woman who knows its ancestors. Nature, her children, all of the species that call one of the last intact, wild, and free places on Earth home are breathing a sigh of relief. For now. The fight isn't over. The Getchewan know this, and they will be at the front lines when the next move comes. The elders who said they'd give their lives before letting the drills through, the woman who showed up in New York City carrying their children's futures on their backs, the ones who looked big oil in the eye and did not blink. The sacred place where life begins is still intact. Go outside tonight. Breathe. That's what it feels like. Hey. And that was, Sarah James from the Gitchewan Nation. And she gave us the Caribou Skin Hunt Dance song. So, victories are wonderful. And I hope it continues. One of the last remaining intact ecosystems in the world. Well, recently, I know I've been talking about, how the U.S. government was really based, all from a native situations. You know, they came with the idea after meeting with the Hanandasi. And so I've been asked several times, to explain more about this. So I'm going to do this now because it's how the Hanandasi shaped America's democracy. And thank you to Indian Country Today for this. Well, more than 270 years ago, the Hanandasi Confederacy showed America's founding fathers just what they've been looking for an example of a thriving democracy where distinct communities could remain sovereign, yet united under one government. Benjamin Franklin, one of the core founding fathers, immersed himself in learning about how six different indigenous nations, the Oneida, Onondaga, Mohawk, Seneca, Cayuga, and Tuscarora, had sustained the oldest continuous democracy in the world. What the Hanandasi showed Franklin during his years of research played a critical role in the development of the United States' Constitution and democratic framework. Quote, for the Hanandasi, we're really known for our democracy. We've been able to have peace for over 1,000 years, said Katsis Isoni Fox, an Akwesasne Mohawk filmmaker and pottery maker. The role the Hanandasi Confederacy played in shaping America's democracy is no secret. Franklin wrote about this inspiration in several letters, and despite this, few Americans realize just how key his interactions with members of the Hanandasi Confederacy were in shaping the United States. In 1744, diplomats from the 13 colonies met with representatives from the Hanandasi Confederacy, which is often mistakenly referred to as the Iroquois Confederacy. The French gave the name Iroquois, which translates to snake, black snake, or enemy in Huron. Amid rising tensions between the 13 colonies and French forces, colonial diplomats decided to schedule a conference with the Confederacy seeking an alliance. The Hanandasi had expressed frustrations toward settler encroachment on their ancestral lands, something the meeting would aim to address. After reading a meeting transcript, Franklin penned a March 20, 1751 letter marking that the way in which these tribes worked together could serve as a perfect model for the future of the 13 colonies. Quote, probably our greatest influence on the founding fathers came through people like Benjamin Franklin, said Scott Manning Stevens, the Akwesasne Mohawk scholar, who is director of the Native American and Indigenous Studies at Syracuse University. Quote, he's looking at the 13 colonies and thinking, all right, we all have different histories and regions and structures. Could we all possibly ever work together? Are we just going to be the 13 little countries? For Franklin, this observation had to be especially interesting, Stevens said. Franklin, who was of British ancestry, would have witnessed the monarchies across Europe at the time. The only other model for a confederacy he could have observed at the time would have come from the Swiss, Stevens said. Well, in 1754, the Hanandasi and English settlers once again convened to discuss their alliance, this time with Franklin in attendance. And following this meeting called the Albany Congress, Franklin gained a better understanding of the Hanandasi Confederacy from a Mohawk chief named Hendrick Theagowin, who was from the Bear Clan. Many of these ideas were eventually woven into the United States Constitution, drafted in 1787. In line with the Hanandasi structure, each of the 13 colonies would present a representative from their respective areas to present their citizens at a greater collective meeting of representatives. This idea is a distinct replication of the structure used by the Hanandasi, in which representatives from each of the six nations gather together and work in the best interest of their respective tribes as well as the collective confederacy. The drafters did, however, take several liberties when following the Hanandasi's lead. They strayed away from the Hanandasi concepts of equal rights, regardless of gender, and the prominent leadership roles held by women. Additionally, the United States copy wasn't an exact replica of what Franklin had observed from the Hanandasi, as it included European traditions from the British Parliament and incorporated the British House of Commons, Stevens said. Quote, so the kind of bicameral setup of our government probably reflects that, and especially since the Hanandasi didn't have any House of Lords, as we didn't have an aristocratic setup, Stevens says. But I think that the notion of doing things via mutual consultation and democratic will is something they learned much more from us than their own system, because their own system wasn't very democratic. For the Hanandasi, this form of governance has lasted somewhere around 1,000 years, with oral histories dating its creation between the years 1100 and 1200, Stevens said. And heading into the United States of America's 250th birthday, there are still lessons the nation can learn from its indigenous people. In particular, there are lessons it can learn from the very people who inspired its unique form of governance. Today, the Hanandasi people exist as 7 nations in Canada and 12 nations scattered throughout the United States. The nations still convene, and when they do, they convene as the original core 6 nations in the Confederacy. Governed by the great law of peace, the Hanandasi's Confederacy democracy is built on mutual respect, trust, and understanding, said Emerson Shenandoah, director of the Shenandoah Great Law of Peace Center in upstate New York. And according to oral history, a man known as the Peacemaker was sent down by the Creator to spread word of peace to the 5 tribes that would become the Hanandasi Confederacy. Traveling from community to community, he persuaded each nation to join together and found a government. In the Onondaga community, the Peacemaker planted the Great Tree of Peace and identified it as a place for the groups to convene. And from above the tree, an eagle would sit and watch for encroaching enemies, and beneath the tree, all the men were instructed to bury their weapons along with any existing greed or jealousy. And I want to interject here, because the Tree of Peace has continued on in the late Jake Swamp, a native of New York, it would plant trees of peace, and he planted one in Central Park, right outside where John Lennon was assassinated. And I remember being there when it was happening, and me and Louise Benali and Stephen Van Sant from Bruce Springsteen's band was there. It was really quite something. And when I interviewed Jake Swamp here on Heart of the Earth, I asked if I could plant a tree of peace. And it's that cedar tree you can see at French's camp. It's up on the hill. And I left some of John Trudell's ashes under that tree. We had a little ceremony there for him. And Reggae on the River came back, and it's thriving, and I hope you come out this summer. But every time I drive by, I look at that tree of peace and say a prayer. But to continue, there are 50 traditional chiefs in the entire Hanandasi Confederacy. 49 of these chiefs come from the 6 nations. Each chief represents a clan within their tribe. The Seneca Nation currently has 8 clan mothers and chief positions. The Cayuga have 10, the Tuscarora have 3, the Onondaga have 14, the Oneida and the Mohawk each have 9. There are currently several vacant positions, according to the Hanandasi Confederacy's official website. And the 50th chief is the Tadodaho, or president, but isn't a president in the same way the United States has a president, said Jameson Wilson, a citizen of the United Nations of Wisconsin's Business Committee and Tribal Council. Tadodaho is the spiritual leader and the highest-ranking chief, but does not make decisions on his own. Unlike the United States president, the Tata Daho cannot issue any executive orders or veto any vote, Shenandoah said. The chiefs are each chosen by the clan mothers. There's no election process for holding the position. Quote, it's not the kind of candidate that the U.S. has. There is no campaigning, said Frida Jaquez, a Turtle Clan mother for the Onondaga Nation. Quote, we're instructed as clan mothers that if someone looks at you or appears to want the position of chief, you're not to give it to them because obviously they don't understand the very seriousness of the position and they probably have ideas about what they can do while they're in there. Clan mothers choose based on observations of community members throughout their lifetimes, Jaquez said. Typically from a young age, someone stands out already as a leader, she said. As those children grow up, the clan mothers continue to observe their behavior and determine if they are fit for the title. And likewise, those chiefs will then go on to select the future clan mothers in a similar fashion. Both positions, clan mother and chief, are lifelong positions and carry immense weight. Quote, chiefs should be sober. They should have family. They should be taking care of family. They should show compassion and be, you know, what they're willing to be to help, willing to be a help to others and don't necessarily need payment for it, Jaquez said. When the men go hunting, maybe they share food with the elders. Maybe they help in the gardens. Maybe they show that they have that kind of character. They're the ones that she looks for. Above all is the great law of peace, the Hanandasi Constitution. Under the great law of peace, all six tribes are equal, though they do hold different roles. Quote, the Onondagas are the firekeepers. They are the ones who accept an eternal message and pass it on to other tribes, Wilson said. Acting as the, quote, older brothers are the Senecas and Mohawks. They receive the message first and deliver it on before it can move on to the younger brothers, which are the Oneidas and Cayugas. The Tuscarora Nation joined the Confederacy later on after they migrated north from the Carolinas into Hanandasi territory. Quote, we view it as the first form of democracy, Wilson said. You have the checks and balances between the elder brothers and the younger brothers. That's like the first version of the checks and balances, and you see that in today's U.S. government structure. The older brothers function like the U.S. House of Representatives, Wilson said, with the younger brothers acting as the Senate. Quote, I think that idea was derived from the Hanandasi Confederacy's government's structure, he said. But unlike the Hanandasi, women had no right or autonomy in the new United States government. They couldn't hold property or speak on behalf of the people, something that ignores a central aspect of the Confederacy's governance. Women have always held a crucial role in Hanandasi society, so much so that they helped to inspire the woman suffrage movement, Shenandoah said. Hanandasi society is matrilineal. Communities are structured around clans. Each Hanandasi person inherits their clan from their mother. Women are responsible for keeping Hanandasi villages organized. The clan mothers directly choose their tribe chiefs and inform them in decision-making. Quote, they, the colonists, had their opinions about women at the time, Jaquez said. Quote, when the Constitution was put together, they did not see, were not able to realize that we did have an influence on what was going on at the time. This aspect of Hanandasi culture was mocked by the colonists, Shenandoah said. They called the chiefs, quote, petticoat chiefs for listening to the clan mothers and didn't seem to understand just how important these women were and that women are at the core of all decision-making in Hanandasi society. If a chief deviates from the tribe's interest, the clan mothers can remove him from his position. Without the clan mothers, the society doesn't function. The colonists also rejected the Hanandasi's respect for the Hanandasi's unique relationship with and respect for the natural world, said Shenandoah, who was also Onondaga and of the Snipe clan. It is an understanding of the relationship not only between people and the earth, but with preserving the environment for those who aren't yet born, he said. So our councils, when they make decisions, they are not just making decisions for the people that are here right now. We are also making decisions for the people that are not yet here, he said. Quote, I think that could be very beneficial to the people of the United States because modern day things such as climate change and data centers are going to have a great effect on people that are not yet here yet. And those people are being forgotten in these decisions that are being made. Few Americans realize the Hanandaze Confederacy and its people are still alive and thriving today, Shenandoah said. Even fewer people know of their role in shaping America. The Great Law of Peace Center aims to educate the surrounding community in upstate New York about the existence, legacy, and resilience of the Hanandaze people, including their role in American democracy. Typically, public schools and even many universities and colleges teach their students that Greece was a major inspiration in shaping America's democracy, but few seem to acknowledge the impact of the Hanandaze. Quote, we get a lot of schools that come from far away, sometimes as far as an hour or so, and many people are just blown away by the fact that they never learned about this in school, Shenandoah said. Quote, they never learned about the original people on the lands that they have lived on their whole life, and then they never learned about how this land was taken as well. And aside from shaping American democracy, leaders of the women's suffrage movement were directly inspired by the power of the Hanandaze women and their matrilineal society, Shenandoah said. Another aspect few Americans know about, suffragists like Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony lived near or sometimes with Mohawk people. Quote, Matilda Jocelyn Gage lived with the Mohawks and was also adopted and given a name by the Mohawks, he said. Quote, in her book, Women, Church, and State, she writes extensively about the Hanandaze Society and how matriarchal society blew her away and was something that she was very keen on compared to the European society at the time, where women had no agency, they had no voice, and they had no rights, versus Hanandaze society, where women had just as much rights as many rights as men. The Hanandaze Confederacy's influence isn't exactly a secret either. The United States Senate formally acknowledged this fact in 1987 through a concurrent resolution formally acknowledging the Hanandaze people's impact on the Constitution. The Library of Congress also features information acknowledging the Hanandaze people's impact on the Founding Fathers. And despite this, many historians and scholars continue to debate whether or not the Hanandaze actually influenced the Founding Fathers, even with existing evidence pointing towards it being fact, according to the Hanandaze Confederacy's website. And as the United States approaches its 250th birthday, there are still several lessons it could learn from the very people who inspired its democracy, Stevens said. In 2026, the Hanandaze Confederacy continues to convene. Typically, the group gathers together at Onondaga, as the tribe serves as the central fire for the Confederacy and traditional gathering place. The Hanandaze Confederacy also regularly attends the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And following forced removals and an international border cutting through their traditional homelands, the six original tribes of the Hanandaze Confederacy exist today as 19 different Hanandaze nations scattered throughout the United States and Canada. And despite the geographical distance and forced removals of the Hanandaze people have faced, the Confederacy continues on. Quote, we're interested in global and indigenous rights, and we are spokespeople for continuing to protect the rights of fellow indigenous peoples all over, Stevens said. But we are still politically viable. We still fight for our rights. We continue to have land claims against both New York and Canada. We fight for environmental issues around clean water and so on. So, you know, it's not just a kind of ceremonial organization. It is our political strength structure today as Six Nations. And that was Howard Lyons of the Mohawk Nation. And his a great CD called Spirit Walk. And what you heard was Yo Jawahe, Mother Earth, Our Holy Place. Well, speaking of women and government, yeah, well, Deb Haaland's decisive victory in New York, in New Mexico's Democratic gubernatorial primary this past week was a political milestone for many Native people. It was also something more personal, the latest chapter in a story that began long before she entered politics. Beginning in July of 2022, Holland from the Laguna Pueblo and Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Brian Newland from the Bay Mills Indian Community led the Interior Department's Road to Healing Tour, a nationwide series of listening sessions held in response to the department's investigation into the federal Indian boarding school systems. Native News Online attended every Road to Healing listening session across the country. Reporting on those sessions was among the most grueling assignments I have undertaken as a journalist, and this is from Levi Rickett. Time and time, survivors of or their descendants recounted horrific stories of physical, emotional, and in many cases sexual abuse they experienced as children in Indian boarding schools. Many of those who testified were elders separated from their boarding school experiences by decades, yet they told their stories with such vivid detail and raw emotion that it often felt as though the trauma had occurred only weeks earlier. The memories remained seared into their minds and hearts, untouched by the passage of time. No matter where the listening sessions were held, from Oklahoma to Alaska, from Michigan to Arizona, the stories carried striking similar themes of loss, punishment, loneliness, and abuse. Different places, different schools, the same pained history. But one testimony has stayed with me more than any other. It's not because of what the speaker said about her own boarding school experience. It was because of what she said about Holland. During a January 22, 2023 Road to Healing session on the Navajo Nation in Arizona, a Navajo woman stood to share her story. Before recounting the pain she had carried for so many years, she spoke directly about what it meant to finally have someone in the federal government who was willing to listen. The woman said she had driven more than 5 hours from Utah to attend the listening session. She recalled weeping when President-elect Joe Biden selected Holland to serve as Secretary of the Interior. Through tears, she explained that she had never believed a Native woman could rise to such a powerful position within the federal government. For months, she said, she had prayed to the Creator for the opportunity to meet Holland. Quote, "Today is a day I get to meet Deb Holland," the Navajo woman proclaimed to the crowd of several hundred people. "When I think about Holland, I think of what she represents to Native people, the Navajo woman's desire to meet Holland and the fulfillment of her wish personified in me. Holland's significance to Indian country." Her words were a reminder that Holland's appointment represented more than a historical political milestone. For many Native people, it was proof that the highest levels of government could finally include someone who understood their history, their communities, and their lived experiences. On Tuesday evening, soon after the polls closed in New Mexico, the Associated Press called the Democratic gubernatorial primary winner Deb Holland. She defeated Bernalillo County District Attorney Sam Bergman, winning 72% of the vote to Bergman's 28%. The margin reflected a broad base of support across the state as an early consolidation of Democratic voters behind Holland's historic candidacy. Historic because, if elected, she will become the first Native American woman to ever be elected governor of a state. With more than 217,000 ballots cast statewide, Holland's win by over 40 percentage points underscored both her political strength and the momentum she carried into the general election as the Democratic nominee for governor. The decisive victory speaks to the strongest campaign Holland ran since announcing her candidacy in February of 2025, less than a month after leaving her post as Secretary of the Interior. She amassed over $11 million in campaign contributions from over 314,000 donors, according to the Deb for New Mexico campaign. And soon after announcing her candidacy, she hit the road and visited 33 counties in the state. In the general election, Holland faces the Republican nominee, Greg Hull, the former mayor of Rio Rancho. A tenacious campaigner, without a doubt, Holland will continue to work hard until Election Day, November 3rd of 2026. Her primary victory speaks to her ability to appeal to a broad coalition of voters. And while her candidacy carries historic significance for Native people, her support extends well beyond Indian country. Part of that appeal stems from her personal story. Before entering Congress, Holland was a single mother who worked her way through law school, at one point selling homemade salsa from the back of her car. Her story resonates with voters who understand the challenges of making ends meet and building a better future for their families. Tuesday's election results demonstrate that her appeal extends far beyond Native communities in New Mexico. Yet, we are still so proud of this Native woman. We are all related. And I can't say enough about Deb Holland, especially the role model that she is for the young Indigenous women. To know that this government refused to acknowledge women when they made their constitution, and even the Equal Rights Amendment hasn't been passed. And last night, I was listening to a woman in Maine and why she voted for Plattner, I believe is his name. And she said, I couldn't vote for that Collins woman because she had promised not to overturn Roe versus Wade. And yet she voted for two Supreme Court justices that she knew would do exactly that. And she betrayed all the women in the state of Maine. So she said, I'm voting for him. Yeah, this is 2026. And there is no equal rights in this country for women. And for Deb Holland to reach as far as she has. I've read so many of her stories. Growing up, living by railroad tracks, living in the pueblos. Yes, selling salsa out of her car so she could go to law school while she was also raising her daughter. Each and every one of us has that strength. We do. And those who feel it know it. Man, those who don't feel it, start digging in. Because the way the earth is right now, it's time to start making some noise. Make some noise in this world. We owe it to the future generations. We owe it to them. I'm going to close with the Rio Grande singers. They are from different pueblos. And this is entitled Spirit of New Mexico, because they get it, New Mexico. And, well, we all are going to really be praying for Deb Holland. She becomes that governor.
Hey, hey. This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.